From Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, this is East Central Europe, Past and Present. Occasionally, we invite visitors to our campus to present their work on East Central Europe and or Russia and Soviet Union and interact with students. This blog series will bring you their views on the past, present, and future of the region and how scholars approach it. And today, we're fortunate to welcome Stephen A. Barnes, who is now Associate Professor of History and the Director of the Center for Eurasian Studies at George Mason University. Plus, he's a colleague of mine. We went to grad school together at Stanford. And the title of his forthcoming book is Death and Redemption, The Gulag and the Shaping of Soviet Society, which is coming out with Princeton University Press in May of next year. And so that's 2010. Welcome, Steve.
2011.
Yes, oh, yes, that's yes. Next year. Thank
yes, next year. Time passes way too fast. Yes. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk to you about stuff. So.
Good, good. So maybe we could start, your project is on the Gulag. And maybe you could just tell us a bit about how you came to be interested in the Gulag.
Sure. So I started the project, strangely enough, with the worst paper that I ever wrote in graduate school. I was taking a course that was not a Russian history course. Basically, you know, I hit one of those quarters where you couldn't find courses to fill what you needed to do. Mm-hmm. So I took a course that had a lot of theory in it. Not really my cup of tea necessarily. The course didn't really work for me terribly well. But the final paper assignment for it was to find a cultural artifact and write about it using some of the theory that we had been reading in the course. And so I went kind of putzing around the library trying to see what I could find and found a catalog of Gulag art from an exhibition that the Memorial Society had held in Moscow in 1990. The catalog had all kinds of stuff in it, drawings that prisoners had done while they were in the camps, drawings that they had done afterwards, paintings, handicrafts, all of this kind of stuff. And it fascinated me because it seemed to speak about something that we didn't know enough about. Which is to say, I think we always thought of the Gulag as, you know, this place that prisoners went to die and they never came back. Mm-hmm. But this spoke to me about some kind of life that was going on there. You know, I was really fascinated by it. I mean, little things, right? So, you know, when you would just look at the materials that were used to create paintings, for example, you would see, you know, paintings on tree bark using pig's blood for paint. Right, but this tells you something about prisoners who are really trying to live mm-hmm. And trying to maintain something of their life in the camps. So anyway, I used this. I wrote a paper. It was absolutely horrendous. But I knew I had something. I knew I was onto the right topic. Mm-hmm. It's just the theory that I was trying to use was not the right way to ask or answer the questions about the camps. So happened the next quarter that I was taking one of my research seminars. And I decided I would continue on and see what I could find. And, you know, started doing lots of background reading. And realized that there was really a crying need. Now, this was, you know, sort of the mid to late 90s, somewhere in there. So people had started looking at archival materials on the camps. But largely what they were focused on was things like the numbers, right? How many prisoners? How many died? You know, how many political prisoners were there? These kinds of things. But nobody had really sort of taken the archives as a way to really look in to see what was happening inside the camp system. So, you know, the further I got into writing that seminar paper, the more I realized that this was what I wanted to, you know, ultimately spend a decade working on mm-hmm. and trying to figure out, you know, what to make of this life that was happening in these places.
Could you tell us a bit about the evolution of that project over time? I mean, did you hit certain setbacks, or did you have a conceptualization that you came in with and that you then were forced to change? Or, you know, what were the important moments along the development of this project, be they conceptual, archival, logistical, that you would want to draw out?
Sure. I actually would say that I was very fortunate multiple times throughout the project, which is to say I was in Moscow in the summer, must have been about 98 or so, doing a sort of pre-trip to kind of figure out, scope out what was in the archives, what I might be able to use in order to then, you know, apply for funding to go abroad and do my research. So while I'm in Moscow working on this stuff, Amir Viner, my PhD advisor, sends me an email and says, the Hoover Institution has just signed an agreement to microfilm the Central Gulag Administration archive and bring it to the Hoover. Right? So I wound up with the bulk of the materials that I would have needed to spend, you know, probably 6, 8, 9 months working on in Moscow, all of a sudden was being brought to my own university. I mean, you know, what an incredible stroke of fortune. Yes. Not to mention that, you know, working in the Hoover archive is a heck of a lot easier than working in any archive in Russia. So, you know, I mean, that was the first big stroke of fortune for me. And then, you know, it was a matter of thinking through how one would approach this. So just to give you a sense of the scope of this system in terms of what a historian can look at. The Hoover microfilm project was originally contracted for 1.5 million frames of microfilm. They overfulfilled their plan. Right, this is more than any one person could ever hope to look at or want to look at. And so you had to figure out a way to write about the Gulag, but make it something that wasn't going to take you your entire life. And we feel like it's taken me too long anyway, right? But you know, that's a lifetime project. So I toyed with various different ideas, right? You could write about a particular period of time. You could write about a particular type of prisoner. I mean, there's all kinds of things that you could do. What I ultimately decided to do, in part actually thanks to some advice that I got from Stephen Kotkin, who came to Stanford when I was there and worked with me and Andy Jinks, another of our fellow graduate students, on our dissertation proposals. And talking to him, and talking to Amir, my advisor, and thinking about things, decided that a local study was actually the way to go. Because it allowed you to maintain all kinds of things that I didn't want to lose. I didn't want to lose chronology. I didn't want this to be a story of just the 30s or just the war or just the post-war or something. Because what I wanted to see is the way in which society in these camps changes over time. And so focusing on a place was a way that would allow me to do that and make it somewhat manageable. I mean, it's still an insane amount of material that's available. And, you know, I would never say that I've looked at everything one could possibly look at, even in terms of this local study. So then, you know, the big issue is what locality, you know, how do you choose a place? And so what I did is I went through and I said, so, you know, what are the things I really want to know about? And I said, I want a place that, you know, has a fairly large camp system so that it's an important place in the system. A place that existed for the bulk of the Stalin years when the Gulag system was at its peak. I wanted a place that had multiple different kinds of institution. So a place that had exiled peoples, a place that had different kinds of forced labor camps. And I was very interested in finding a place that had one of, there was a series of uprisings in the camps that happened after Stalin died. And so ultimately it came down, there were three possible locations to do this and to accomplish all of these things. Two of them were north of the Arctic Circle, and one was in Kazakhstan. And I thought, you know, Kazakhstan actually sounds pretty nice. There's actually, you know, some light there during the winter. I thought at the time, too, that maybe getting out of Russia would tell me a somewhat different story. Now, that part, I would say, did not turn out to be the case. It's a Soviet story. So I always tell people, I'm not a Central Asian historian, even though I did my work in Kazakhstan. Because what I got there and found out is that this was a Soviet story. It was an institution that was directly subordinate to Moscow. And there was very, very little in terms of something particular about it being in that spot as opposed to somewhere else. So I chose this place in Kazakhstan, Karaganda. It's an area where there were big coal mines. But the camp, unlike what we generally think of in terms of forced labor camps, was not a mining camp. What they were doing was trying to create agriculture in the steppe. This is sort of a semi-desert area where historically the Kazakhs were a nomadic people and they would herd their animals around the steppe. So they were trying to create agriculture in this area and they were using prisoners to do it. But the camps in that place, and two in particular that I focus on especially, one called Karlag and one called Steplog. So Karlag exists from, well, the predecessor to it in 1930, Karlag itself in 30 or 31, and then all the way up past the end of the Stalin years. So this covered the chronology that I was looking for. There were a lot of exiled peoples in the area. There was this camp called Steplog, one of a very small number of what they called special camps that were created in 1948 after the war. This was for those that they called especially dangerous state criminals. And I wanted to kind of understand that system too. And so there's one of these camps there. And then my other criteria, right, there was a huge uprising that happened in Kingir. This is just outside of the city of Jizkazgan in Kazakhstan. Quite famous uprising. Solzhenitsyn devotes an entire chapter to it in Gulag Archipelago called the 40 Days of Kingir. And this is a moment in which the prisoners literally kick the guards and the administration out of the camp zone and hold the camp zone for 40 days until it's overrun by tanks. So where the luck came in for me is that I was able to do all of the kinds of stuff that I would have needed to do in Moscow at Stanford, at the Hoover. And this allowed me to focus my overseas research on this particular locality in Kazakhstan. You know, I mean, I was married at the time. It's very, very difficult on a personal level to leave your wife behind. She's, you know, a couple years out of law school. She can't pick up from her career and, you know, come with me for a year. I mean, it would destroy her career. And so, you know, I'm trying to find a way to do this as efficiently as possible to get home to my wife. And this is where I was so incredibly fortunate in having those materials brought to Stanford. So I go to three places during the course of my research here. Then I do spend some time in Moscow because there are some materials there that I need to see that, that is not part of the microfilm project. I go to Almaty, which was the former capital of the Kazakh Republic. And then I go to Karaganda, the city around which this camp was based. And, you know, what I find is that of this 8 or 9 month research trip, it's the materials I found in the last 2 or 3 months that make up the bulk of the material that I use from that trip in the book, in the dissertation and now the book. That's for a couple of reasons. One, because I think like all graduate students, I'm flailing a little bit at first. You know, it's like you're trying to figure out how to work the archives, you know, how to get them to not yell at you, actually give you the materials that you want to see, right? These kinds of things. And trying to figure out exactly what it is that you're looking for. Even though I'd had this time at Stanford working on stuff, I mean, you're still not quite certain where you're at. So in part is that, but in part I found an absolute treasure trove when I got to Karaganda. And here it's, again, it's fortune, it's luck. So the materials that I worked with there were the administrative materials for Karlag, the camp that was in that area. They were held in something with this crazy long name, right? It was the Archival Department of the Center for Information and Legal Information, or no, Center for Legal Information and Statistics under the Procuracy of the Karaganda Region. Yeah. I can never remember. It's just huge. It's like an alphabet soup once you get to the acronym for this. But anyway, but the lucky part here, right, is that this institution is run by a man who has very liberal inclinations, who thinks that this material should be known, and therefore gives me access to it. None of the materials I worked with there had been legally declassified. But he felt that he had the authority, as the director of this institute that held these materials, to give access to these materials to scholars. So, I mean, here it's a complete luck, right? If it was a different director with a different attitude, I don't get any of this stuff. Instead, I get access to materials there that you can't even touch in Russia. I look at individual prisoner files. Materials on individuals is almost impossible to come by in many places in Russia because the law specifically talks about 75 years after, you know, and these kinds of things. So I'm just, you know, I get this amazing, amazing material that's real nitty-gritty on the ground. I mean, you see the way in which, you know, what Moscow says is not always what happens once you get to a local place. Right, you see Moscow saying you've got to create camp newspapers, and you see them using the paper in the camps to roll cigarettes instead of to create these newspapers. Right, the newspapers did actually exist. I mean, they produced some of these too. But I mean, these are the kinds of things, and there's always these competing, I guess, priorities. You know, Moscow's telling you to do this, and they're telling you to do that, and you can't do one without not doing the other, right? You can't abide by this decree without violating that one. So they're saying, for example, to camps that you cannot have prisoners sentenced for so-called counter-revolutionary crimes, those that we kind of generally think of as political prisoners. That's all really a problematic issue. But they cannot live outside of camp zones. Right, zone being the barbed wire enclosure that you sort of think of when you think of a labor camp. Well, in fact, this agricultural camp, because of the nature of the work that they did, their prisoners spend a lot of time out on the steppe. And they don't go to a zone at night. And so they're being told, on the one hand, you can't let this group of prisoners live outside of a camp zone. But on the other hand, you've got all this economic stuff that you have to do. That you have to produce. And, you know, they fight against each other, these two sort of competing priorities. And so a camp director basically has to think, you know, what am I least likely to get in trouble for? And, you know, I mean, what they often do in this case is that these prisoners are actually allowed to go out and move around the steppe. You know, this is one of the many ways in which, you know, much of the gulag doesn't look like the picture that we have of it in our mind. You know, we think of one day in the life of Ivan Denisovich. That kind of experience certainly exists in the gulag and is an important part of it. And this story is actually set in one of these special camps that I mentioned earlier. But this is not the only experience of the camps. There are prisoners in Karlag who are out on the steppe without even a guard.
Really?
And they just are living out on the steppe doing their work. And the guards check in every now and then to see that they're still there, right? And so, you know, there's all kinds of things there that are happening that I thought you had to, you know, spend some time looking into. You know, but I guess my point with this sort of long discussion is, you know, a lot of fortune goes into writing any book. Sometimes it's misfortune. I mean, I had terrible, terrible difficulties getting into the archives at all in Almaty. But it turned out the materials there weren't that important to me. Mm-hmm. Not as important as I thought they would be. Mm-hmm. But I feel like, you know, it's a lot of luck that's involved in the whole process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess making the most of the fortune that does come your way.
Yeah, well said. So, what? Maybe you could summarize briefly the argument of your book for us and talk about how you think it will be received, or, you know, how this argument will play in various circles, like in today's Russia, in places like Kazakhstan, in the historiography of the United States, and or Western historiography, let's say.
Sure, tiny question. I can answer that in 2 minutes. Well, you know, my book starts from a couple of things. You know, I talked about this archival work that had been done in the late Soviet, early post-Soviet period. And this, in some ways, provides the background for my work. And, you know, it's really fundamentally about, you know, based upon two things is my starting point. One is something we've always known, which is millions of prisoners died in the camps. But there was something else, and this is something that was discovered by some of these early scholars, Viktor Zemskov, one of the most important, a Russian scholar. 20 to 40% of the camp population is released every year throughout the Stalin era. 20 to 40%. I mean, if I remember the figures precisely, it's never less than 115,000 who were released in a given year. I think that's from probably 34 to 53. And the number that's released sometimes over 500,000. So I start with these two things, right? And I say, if this many people are getting out of the camps, then we've got all kinds of questions we have to ask. Who's getting out? What is being done, if anything, to prepare them for returning to Soviet society? Which is to say, do we take the Gulag seriously as a penal institution? And fundamentally, my argument is yes, we have to. We have to pay attention to this. We have to see how the struggle on the part of the individual prisoner to be one of that 20 to 40% shapes their lives. We have to see the way in which Soviet authorities are shaping a system that allows for a determination of who's going to be released and who's not. That is to say, who's going to die there. We look at these things and we see the way in which life in the camps is shaped. The society is shaped. There is a society in these camps. We find then that many aspects of what you might consider modern political practices, modern state practices, modern penal practices, play an incredibly important role in the camps. For example, categorization of peoples. This is something that, you know, many historians identify as a very important part of the modern world. States are trying to categorize their populations so as to get some sense of who their population is, what problems there are in their population that the state can then intervene and try to fix. So it's this very activist notion of the state, a state that you know, is more than just, you know, getting recruits for the military and collecting some taxes, but a state that's trying to shape its population. Well, what we find then is if you look at categorization in the camps is that this plays an incredibly important role in this determination of who's going to get out and who's not. So prisoners are constantly being identified according to categories, and I think of them as two sets of categories. First, who was the prisoner at the point of their arrival in the camps? So this is things like the crime that they'd allegedly committed, which is very important, but also you know, whether or not they'd been members of the Communist Party, whether they had served in the Red Army, this becoming particularly important after the war, whether they'd served at the front, these kinds of things, their gender, their nationality, or ethnicity, you know, is this sort of problematic Russian terminology, trying to turn it into English. But, I mean, you get a sense of what I'm talking about, you know, whether they're Kazakh or Russian or Kyrgyz or, you know, one of these types of things. And then there's who they had become while they were in the camps. And so this is looking at a different set of things. It's about their behavior in the camps. It's very importantly about their fulfillment or non-fulfillment of their daily labor quota. It's about whether they participated in cultural activities in the camps. It's about the current state of their health. What I find, and I explore throughout the book, is the way in which all of these categories impact the capacity of an individual to survive. So let me just pick a couple and give you a sense. So this issue of who a person was before they entered the camps. If you take those that were arrested under Article 58, so-called counter-revolutionaries, those that we think of as political prisoners, again, with this being a little bit of a problematic notion, what we see is that these are the people that the state was most afraid of, and therefore the people that are least likely to get out. Now, how does this translate into practices in the camps? A number of different things. One, they're typically given the longest sentences. They're going to spend them in the most remote locations, doing the hardest kinds of labor. But also, there is a program throughout the 1930s, which I think you could call in English like accounted working days, but you can think of it as something like time off for good behavior. Which is to say, if you perform 100% of your labor quota today, then today counts like a day and a half toward the completion of your sentence. If you perform 120%, it counts as 2 days. And these ratios change a lot over time, but I mean, you kind of get the point, right? Well, political prisoners, these counter-revolutionaries, as the Soviet state would call them, were specifically excluded from this program of early release. When amnesties happen, and they happen multiple times throughout the history of the Gulag, counter-revolutionary criminals are often excluded from these amnesties. So again and again, you see ways in which, you know, they're going to have the hardest time getting through this experience. So ultimately, you know, this question of whether they're a political prisoner or not doesn't matter that much once they get in the camps, because if you enter the camps with Article 58 attached to your prisoner file, it has very real consequences for your capacity to survive. Now, there are people who survived, even among this group. I mean, Evgeny Ginzburg, we can think of one of the most famous Gulag memoirists herself, arrested as a counter-revolutionary, serves her 10 years, gets out, ultimately then rearrested and sent into permanent exile, but she survives the experience. You know, and through some of the worst years. I mean, the war years are the deadliest years in the history of the camps. I try to look at a lot of different ways in which the institutions are working together to try to help determine who a prisoner was, and to apply a certain type of punishment to this prisoner according to what I think of as a sort of hierarchy. And you think of it in two ways, and it depends on which way you're organizing your hierarchy. It's either a hierarchy of danger, or it's a hierarchy of redeemability. But it's basically, you know, this question of how likely they are to get out. And so we see that, you know, within this broad category of the labor camp, there are light division camps, regular division camps, strict division camps. There will ultimately be created divisions called katorga, using this old old Russian term for forced labor. They create these special camps. Actually, go all the way to the other end. There are these people that are actually moving about and living outside of camp zones altogether with no guards. So there's a whole range of things that all fit into what is a, you know, so-called corrective labor camp. What I try to see then is, you know, where you wind up in this has a lot to do with the way in which you've been categorized by the state. And these categories can change. You know, this categorization can change. This is all about the you know, who you became while you were there. And so labor and your labor productivity becomes this measure of your, you know, so-called redemption, re-education, whatever. I mean, you know, these terms which seem so problematic to our ears to think about with the Gulag, and they are, I mean, given the brutality of the system. You know, I mean, it really makes a difference. You can wind up in lighter and lighter regimes, or harsher and harsher regimes, and these are going to directly relate to your capacity to survive the camps. Now, what's clear is, you know, the Soviets, they were not humanists, right? I mean, this is the understatement of the year. But they didn't mind if people died. By, you know, sort of the lowest estimates we can come up with, at least something like 1.6 million die in the camps. This is not to count people who died in the process of exile. This doesn't count people who were executed. You know, this is a huge number. And what I found is that you rarely found a camp being criticized for excessively high death rates. Now, excessively high escape rates? Absolutely. This is the worst thing that can happen. But death, well, you know, I mean, that's just kind of expected. It's part of the deal. This is going to happen. Even I found this amazing propaganda photo, which is on our website, gulaghistory.org. And this is a whole different project I worked on. But this amazing propaganda photo of a, it's called the Graveyard of the Lazy. And it's these false graves of prisoners where each of the stakes that have the prisoner's name on it will say, like, Mavlanov, 25%, you know, Petrov, 35%. And the clear indication here is, right, they didn't perform their labor quota, and so they died. And so you see, they're not ashamed to talk about the deaths that happen in the system. It's just part of the way it works. And thinking about, you know, what the reception of all of this is going to be, You know, I mean, it's a little hard to know. I've presented the work orally a lot of places, and I've always expected, thought perhaps, that you know, maybe members of the Russian immigrant community would come up and be very upset about the way that I was talking about all of this. But in fact, not. They usually think that I'm spot on. Now, you know, what I always try to make clear whenever I talk about this, and it's right there in the title of the book, Death and Redemption, is that it's about both things. It's about those people that got out, but it's also about those people that died there. And I think it's the fact that I keep the eye on this that has prevented any sort of significant, like, you know, well, you're a Stalin apologist kind of thing. I mean, by no means am I in any sense an apologist for anything. But I think it's a system that we have to understand the complicated nature of it. In terms of, you know, what the scholarly reaction is going to be, I don't actually expect a lot of resistance to what I argue, to the crux of the argument. And I could be wrong. And maybe it's just because I'm so deeply into it and I'm so deeply convinced that I've got this thing, you know, just about right. Not to say that I'm right in every single detail and every little bit of the analysis, but I think the overall picture I present is really how we need to look at this system. You don't look at it just as a slave labor system. You don't look at it as just a way to get rid of political opponents, but you look at it as something that is embedded within this Soviet attempt to define their population, to reshape their population, and to create, you know, something like called the new Soviet person, or to create something that is Soviet society or socialist society, with socialist in quotation marks, because exactly what was ever meant by that was never quite clear.
Maybe you could talk about the future now, specifically your own and also the fields. Where do you see work on the Soviet Union going in the future? What do you consider to be the most interesting and exciting directions in Soviet history right now? And what are your own plans for your next project?
Sure. Well, a couple of things, and you know, maybe the way I see the field going is because of what I'm doing next, which is to say I think maybe I'm going in the direction that the field is, which is to say that there's a real push chronologically in our field to go beyond the Stalin years. That has for so long been territory that was, you know, initially ceded to political scientists and then really just not looked at by historians much for many, many years, only very, very few. And so there is quite a lot of work that's going, you know, beyond 1953 now. You know, I mean, my book, this book does that itself. I mean, I try to go well into the post-Stalin years to see what becomes of this system later. But I think, you know, people are really trying to push into some understanding of, you know, what do you make of the Soviet Union without Stalin? I mean, it's an overwhelming question, I think, because Stalin was such an overwhelming presence. And I think the Soviet populace themselves and the Soviet leadership were trying to figure out, you know, what does it mean to be without this person who put this thing together in many respects. So there's been a lot of work that's being done right now, particularly in the Khrushchev years, the years of the thaw. That seems to be, you know, particularly hot topic in terms of what a lot of graduate students seem to be working on these days. My own plans actually go even a little beyond that. And I'm doing something in many ways quite different, which is rather than focusing on one place for a long period of time, I'm focusing on many places for a short period of time. So I'm writing a history of 1968 in the Soviet Union. So not about the decision to invade Prague. I mean, that's being done by other people. It's very important work, but that's not my interest. My interest is, what do people in the Soviet Union know about what's going on around the world in 1968? Obviously, Prague looms huge over this entire year. You know, the Prague Spring and then the invasion and the aftermath of the invasion. But, you know, 1968 is this amazing year across the world, from, you know, bloody suppression of student uprisings in Mexico to the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement in the United States, the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, massive strikes in France in May of 68. And you go all the way across, right, to the Chinese Cultural Revolution is at its height in this period. And all of this not to even mention then what happened in Prague, right? So what I'm trying to get a sense of is, what did people know about it, all of these things that were happening in the world? What did they think about it? Did it change the way that they thought about the Soviet system at all? Some of the human rights activists, the dissidents, identify in their memoirs the invasion of Prague as a crystallizing moment in which they could no longer believe in, you know, call it the Soviet system, call it socialism, communism, whatever. I'm interested if it's more than this tiny group of people. And so there are a number of things then that I'm trying to understand. It's about information flow in a state that is trying its best but unsuccessfully to maintain a monopoly over the spread of information. There's a significant geographical component to what I'm doing. So I'm doing a series of local studies across the Soviet Union, from Blagoveshchensk out on the Amur River on the Chinese border, to Perm in the Urals, to Chernivtsi on the Romanian border in Ukraine, I'm going to work somewhere in the Caucasus too. I kind of keep going back and forth about where exactly I'm going to work there. But basically, I'm trying to see, you know, does it matter what's happening in Prague when you're in Blagoveshchensk, which is like half a world away? Are they not more interested in the Chinese Cultural Revolution? So, you know, I'm trying to look at how it's different in different places. When you're on the Romanian border and you have all these Romanian tourists coming in and bad-mouthing the Soviet Union in 68, does that matter? So I think we're beginning to push toward a real serious scholarly approach to the elephant in the room, which is, why did it all fall apart in the end? And I guess, you know, to an extent, I'm questioning, you know, is 68 the beginning of that collapse? It's not the overriding drive for the project, but it's part of it. But I think scholars are going to be moving more and more seriously into looking at, in a very serious manner, how the system comes apart, and how 91 happens. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's lots of interesting work that's being done.
Great. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful having you, and I hope we'll have you here again.
Thanks, Holly.